pictures of a relative into class. Of course, the people don't know why they're doing this. So the next week, they bring a picture of a relative and they give them darts and say, now we're going to throw darts at these pictures of your relatives. So they give them the actual experience of what Arjuna must have been experiencing. So this is so well thought out, how they teach it. So it's one of the most dynamic programs going on. And there's also several yoga centers in New York, and the devotees are connecting with those yoga centers. And one of the new yoga centers, one of the lady who's in charge of it is becoming a devotee now. So they're giving classes there, and 30, 40 people are coming to hear philosophy and paying for it. So it's really wonderful. I attended a class. One of the classes was given. About 25 people came and paid $20 and heard an hour and a half lecture, very wonderful lecture on karma, psychology of karma. So very dynamic scene in New York. And Yogeshwar is teaching Bhagavad Gita at Jivan Mukti Yoga Center. Now he and Rasanath are giving a class in Ramayana. That's their next thing. So, you know, there are other things going on. There are three yoga teachers at the Bhakti Center, and other dynamic programs are going on. Sanskrit is being taught, cooking, and so aesthetic. The Gita Sutras, yeah. Yeah, I guess they had designed the Bhakti Center in a way that people are coming to other classes, and that's how they're learning about the Gita classes. These things are going on. Hare Krishna. So we'll read today's verse, which is chapter 6, verse 3 through 7. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, chapter 6, texts 3 through 7. So I'll read 3 through 6, Sanskrit in the translation, and then we'll chant text 7. This is text 3. Ete cetra prasutabai punaste angirashaha smitaha ratitaranam prabharaha citropeta dvijataya. Having been born from the womb of Ratitara's wife, all these sons, let's read the previous verse referring to the sons. Previous verse, text 2, Ratitara had no sons, and therefore he requested the great sage Angira to beget sons for him. Because of his request, Angira begot sons in the womb of Ratihara's wife. All these sons were born with brahminical prowess. Having been born from the womb of Ratitara's wife, all these sons were known as the dynasty of Ratihara. But because they were born from the semen of Angira, they were also known as the dynasty of Angira. Among all the progeny of Ratitara, these sons were the most prominent because owing to their birth, they were considered Brahmins. Text 4. Chuvatastu mano jhagye ishvako granataha sutaha tasya putra shatat shre jeshtha vikukshki nimidandakaha. The son of Manu was Ishvaku. When Manu was sneezing, Ishvaku was born from Manu's nostrils. King Ishvaku had 100 sons, of whom Vikushki, Minimi, and Dandaka were the most prominent. Purport. According to Sridhar Swami, although the Bhagavatam 9.1.11 and 12 has previously included Ishvaku among the 10 sons begotten by Manu and his wife Shraddha, this was a generalization. It is here specifically explained that Ishvaku was born simply from the sneezing of Manu. Text 5. Tesham kurashtad abhavan arya bhartate nripa nripa panchavingshat iti paschaccha trayo madhye parentaha parinyataha. Of the 100 sons, 25 became kings in the western side of Aryavarta, a place between the Himalaya and the Vindhya mountains. Another 25 sons became kings in the east of Aryavarta, and the three principal sons became kings in the middle. The other sons became kings in various other places. Text 6. Sa ikadash shtaka shadhe ishvako sutam adishat mangsham anitatham medyam vikukshe gachamam chiram. During the months of January, February, and March, oblations offered to the forefathers are called Ashtaka Shraddha. The Shraddha ceremony is held during the dark fortnight of the month. When Maharaj Ikshvaku was performing his oblations in this ceremony, he ordered his son Vikukshi to go immediately to the forest to bring some pure flesh. And today's verse we can chant together. Tateti savanam gatva Mrigam hatva kriyarhanam Shanto bubukshito bhira. Not up there. Sasham chadat apasmitihi Sasham chadat apasmitihi Tateti savanam gatva Tisav Mrigan hatva kriyarhanam Shanto bubikshito bhira Shasham chadad apasmitihi. Since it's late and it's not up, I'll just read the translation. Thereafter, Ikshvaku's son Vikukshi went to the forest and killed many animals suitable for being offered as oblations. But when fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful and ate a rabbit he had killed. Purport. It is evident that Kshatriyas killed animals in the forest because the flesh of the animals was suitable to be offered at a particular type of yajna. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the ceremony known as Shraddha is also a kind of yajna. In this yajna, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. However, in the present age, Kali Yuga, this kind of offering is forbidden. Quoting from the Brahma Vaivatra Purana, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Ashvamedam gavalabham sanyasam palapaichikam devarena sutopatim kalo pancha vivarjayat. In this age of Kali, five acts are forbidden: the offering of a horse in sacrifice, the offering of a cow in sacrifice, the acceptance of the order of sannyas, the offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and a man's begetting children in his brother's wife. The word palapaitrikam refers to offering of flesh in oblations to forefathers. Formerly such an offering was allowed, but in this age it is forbidden. In this Kali Yuga, everyone is expert in hunting animals, but most of the people are Shudras, not Kshatriyas. According to Vedic injunctions, however, only Kshatriyas are allowed to hunt, whereas Shudras are allowed to eat flesh after offering goats or other insignificant animals before the deity of the goddess Kali or similar demigods. On the whole, meat-eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to eat meat according to various circumstances and injunctions. As far as eating beef is concerned, however, it is strictly prohibited to everyone. Thus, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna personally speaks of gorakshan, cow protection, meat eaters according to their different positions and the directions of the Shastra are allowed to eat flesh, but never the flesh of cows. Cows must be given all protection. So, I would like to read a story about a cow. Would you like to hear a cow story? This is from the book Animals in Krishna Consciousness. Has anyone seen this book? This is written by Jananandan Swami. And these are all stories about Krishna conscious animals. I thought you would enjoy this story. Because most of us don't have deep connection with cows. Most of us are not taking care of cows, not milking cows, not farming with bulls. Many of us have never even grown a vegetable, planted a seed, where many of us are city slickers. So stories like this are helpful. I know when I went to Mauritius, it was the first time I actually saw how certain vegetables grew. I had no idea. Pelham Estate is famous among devotees in Malaysia. Since 1983, we have been having regular devotional programs there. It's a small rubber plantation with a village. Dozens of serious devotees have come from this estate. So in other words, it's a big rubber plantation and devotees live there, and they actually have two temples there on the rubber plantation. On Pelham Estate, there are two Hindu temples. As many of the workers are Telugus, one of the temples is of Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman. It's small but beautiful. We would have programs there. One day, a placid-looking cow wandered into the temple. She stood motionless before the deities and then spontaneously passed urine on the floor. If you don't know, this is considered a very auspicious sign, not for human babies, but for cows. This was around 1987. From then on, she kept coming to the temple. She belonged to a local farmer, but in Malaysia, they just let the cows wander, so she'd come every day. When she found out we were having weekly programs in a shop, so they were having weekly programs in a shop, not in the temple, over near the temple, she came there every week without fail. She was quickly accepted by all the devotees as a member of the congregation. She would stand at the back of the hall the whole way through the kirtan. And then, astonishingly, during the class, she would sit down on the floor in the middle of the matajis. And there are pictures here of her sitting. You can't see them, but she's sitting in the back next to the matajis. She would almost always stay till the end of class, sitting motionless. I noticed when the class, this is in Malaysia, so she didn't speak English. So he says here, I noticed when the class was in English, she would sometimes get restless. So that means she must have been relishing it in, you know, in, what's the language? Malay? Tamala? Mm-hmm. She definitely couldn't understand English. After class came, her favorite part of the program was prasadam. She would relish, sometimes a little over-enthusiastically, the nectarian prasadam of Lord Ram, sitting down either inside or outside with a banana leaf in front of her. She would lap everything up, including the leaf, and then start on her neighbor's plates. After a while, the program was switched to Mahateja Prabhu's house in a different part of the estate. Somehow, Vishaka, as she became known, immediately found out, and there she was at the program. She never missed. She developed a deep attachment for Mahateja Prabhu, and if she saw him driving his motorbike, she would run after him. She loved devotee association. Whenever there was a kirtan program on the estate, you could bet your boots Vishaka would be there. She would walk around with her ears pricked up, listening for the sound of the kirtan. Then she would run in that direction. When she found out Mahateja was holding Mangal Aarti in his house at 5 a.m. alone, she alone would be there. Somehow, without her owner's knowledge, she'd sneak out to attend. So it was Mahateja and Vishaka at Mangal Aarti. She was the only one there. If only we had that kind of enthusiasm. She would just stand there gazing at the deities. I guess she would have been singing along if she could have. She was by far and away the most regular attendee at the programs. Daily she would come for prasadam. One day a horrible incident took place. Unfortunately, it is the custom of one non-Hindu group to celebrate a certain festival by eating beef. Whoever has cows at that time is tempted to sell them, or kind of forced to sell them. The owner of Vishaka fortunately refused to sell her. you don't sell a wanted cow, you have to watch them like a hawk. The owner didn't. And one day, a lust-crazed local threw burning acid over Vishaka's body, causing terrible skin injuries. In other words, they did this because they thought then he'll sell the cow, because they wanted to use the cow in sacrifice. They go, the cow's useless now. This way, they think the cow will become useless and he will sell at a lower price. Vishaka would have died from the wounds within a few days, but Krishna had another plan. She is a devotee, and Krishna says, declare boldly, my devotee will never be vanquished. Krishna protected her through a severe test of faith. For those who surrender to me, I protect them. When the devotees found out what happened, they quickly summoned a local doctor, who was also himself a devotee. He arranged the best of medicines and care. After a few days, the sores started to heal. The aggressor was foiled. Although she soon was back on her feet, she could not come to the programs for quite a while, as her body looked very wretched. This is really interesting. I think she felt too contaminated. She was very shy and humble. Devotees, in other words, she could walk, but she didn't come to the programs. Devotees would take prasadam to her during this period. After a while, her wounds cleared up, and then she started coming. Now she was even more determined and decided it was time to preach. Pay attention, it gets better. Saturday came and Vishaka was not the lone cow anymore. There she was with a whole bunch of them standing outside looking in. You could see they're like, I don't know if you can see, they're like 6-8 cows here. Standing outside and looking in. She tried her best, but they weren't quite ready to surrender. So they didn't come in the temple yet. Still, she got them lots of prasadam. They saw the deities and they heard some Krishna katha. Vishaka would come to the temple door, look at them and motion them. Come on, girls. It was shortly after her recovery that she gave birth to a baby bullock whom the devotees named Prahlad. At that time, the owner eventually agreed to sell Vishaka to the devotees, together with her newborn son. With great delight, she joined the ashram. The devotees quickly constructed a cow shed on a small piece of land with a local friend. A local friend let them use. Vishaka and Prahlad were soon joined by the rest of ISKCON Malaysian cows who moved from their previous location to get Vishaka's association. In this way, Vishaka spent her last days peacefully under the loving protection of the devotees. During her last 2 weeks, she could not walk, giving the devotees the wonderful opportunity to serve such an elevated soul, soul dear to Krishna. When there was no one there to do kirtan, the tape of Prabhupada would be playing sometime around 1993. She left the world hearing the ambrosial sound emanating from Prabhupada's lotus mouth. Such a great cow is very, very rare. So, I was just thinking when I was reading this verse how people have no conception of what's going on. And in my preaching to people, one of the things that I asked them, what is your belief behind meat eating? And of course, people generally aren't questioned, what is your belief behind something? And it's very, very powerful. And they don't really know. They're grappling to understand. So I help them. I say, isn't it the belief that some animals are pets and some animals are food? And so they'll think about it. They'll say, yes. And I'll say, well, who decides which animals are pets and which animals are food? And so they're trying to grapple with it because they think religiously they can justify it. And I kind of coax them on to realize that it's a cultural, not a religious understanding. Because you may know the story that one man went to a restaurant in Hong Kong with his dog, and he couldn't bring the dog into the restaurant, so whoever was outside, the maitre d' or whatever, he just said, can you take care of my dog? He said, certainly I can take care of your dog. They had their dinner and they came out, and many of you know the story, the dog wasn't there, and after further inquiry he found out that what they mean take care of the dog was kill it, serve it, and we'll eat it for dinner, which is what happened. So in that culture, eating dogs is, this is common. And in America, eating dogs is considered what? Illegal, abominable, horrible? So who decided that dogs were pets and cows weren't? Who made that decision? Is it in the Bible that cows are not to... Well, the Bible didn't make the distinction between dogs and cows and pigs, did it? What's that? Dominion over the animals. So we decided, each culture decides where you draw the line between the pets and the food, where the food chain ends and the pet chain begins. And then, of course, in our society, there's a gray area because pigs can be both. And if a pig becomes a pet, then killing that pig is criminal, right? Yeah. So there may be some, of course, even Prabhupada says, you know, if you're going to kill something, you know, don't kill a cow. But generally, for people just off the street who have no knowledge, they... making them aware that they're not seeing a cow as a pet and they're seeing a dog as a pet, and that's why they're distinguishing. It's helpful. It kind of throws them for a loop, in my experience, just to examine that. So, it's getting late, and there's another aspect of this verse that I thought was very interesting we could discuss, and I'm not an expert cowherd boy. Uchira is the cowherd girl. She should have given this course. You milk the cows, or your husband milks them? No, so they should have given this class. I'm not really qualified. So I'm not qualified to speak on the next part of this verse, but I have some association with it, so I'll speak on it. And this is the we are forbidden to take sannyas in the age of Kali. And a very wonderful description of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's. He was the one who reintroduced in the modern age Tridandi sannyas. And so there's a history of it in this book, Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Bhai Baba, which I was reading this morning, and I thought, better than me try to explain it, I would miss some of the details. I will read it, and we can discuss it. I think it's very helpful for us. So we read the verse that five acts are forbidden, and now we're going to discuss the act of taking sannyas in the age of Kali. That says it's forbidden. Is it actually forbidden? And is it really forbidden, or what aspect of it is forbidden? Vaishnav sannyas being unheard of in Bengal at this time in Bengal. There was nobody. Vaishnav sannyas, in other words, the Tridandi sannyas of the saffron robes, was unheard of. Vaishnav sannyas being unheard of in Bengal, Srila Saraswati Thakur and his disciples had to repeatedly uphold its validity to skeptical inquirers, many of whom cited a Brahma Vaivarta Purana verse that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself quoted, which is the verse we quoted today, that in Kali Yuga nobody should take sannyas. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati would reply that Mahaprabhu had cited this reference to rebut a sinful anti-Vedic Muslim magistrate who wanted to justify beef eating on the basis of Vedic scripture. And within that debate, the topic of sannyas was mentioned only circumstantially. I think this is, isn't this Mahaprabhu's discussion with the Qazi? He quoted this verse, you know, Pushkar. I think this is what's being referred to. In other words, he's debating, we know the conversation with the Qazi, and Mahaprabhu said, you're eating your mother. And so this verse is being quoted, so Bhaktisiddhanta is saying, the part about sannyas is just circumstantially there. He was quoting it to make the point that it's sinful to eat meat. That's point one. There are many other points. In other words, Mahaprabhu never stressed prohibition of sannyas, but instead demonstrated the contrary shortly thereafter by himself embracing sannyas. Nor in doing so did he violate Shastra, because the injunction forbidding sannyas in Kali Yuga is from a Rajashic Purana, meant for karmis and applies to karma sannyas, to be undertaken exclusively by pure Vedic Brahmins who know, and these pure Vedic Brahmins no longer exist in Kali Yuga, and thus whose mode of renunciation should not be imitated by unqualified men. Should I read that again? Nor in doing so did he violate Shastra, because the injunction forbidding sannyas in Kali Yuga is from a Rajashika Purana meant for karmis and applies to karma sannyas, not Vaishnava sannyas, to be undertaken exclusively by pure Vedic Brahmins who no longer exist in Kali Yuga. So the injunction is for Brahmins who don't even exist. And it's not for Vaishnava sannyas. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati further explained that this scriptural directive was never meant to restrain suitable persons from dedicating their whole self to the intrinsic function of the soul, namely service to the Supreme Lord. Moreover, the smarta Rahunandana, I don't know who this is, the smarta Rahunandana had prescribed a full day fast as atonement for failing to offer respect upon first seeing a sannyasi, confirmed this smarta named Raghunandana had said that if you see a sannyasi and you don't pay obeisances, you should atone by fasting. So he's saying that this injunction, he's saying seeing a sannyasi confirmed, this conjunction confirms that even the most fastidious adherents to the Shastriya requirements had recognized the concept of sannyas in Kali Yuga. So he's saying even the smartest recognized that there was sannyas is bona fide because of this injunction. If you see a sannyasi, you should, and don't pay obeisances, you should fast. So they recognized it. Ideological enemies further accused Srila Siddhanta Saraswati of impropriety for taking sannyas by himself. But the precedent had been set by the great Vaishnavacharya Sri Ramanuja. So Bhaktisiddhanta had got the idea of Tridandi sannyas by studying the Sri Sampradaya. Although in recent generations sannyas in the Gaudiya Sampradaya had been practically unheard of, Sri Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati pointed out that not only was Lord Chaitanya a sannyasi, but so were his guru and paramaguru. That 9 sannyasi associates of Mahaprabhu are listed in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita as roots of the Chaitanya tree, and that Srimad Prabhudananda Saraswati, a prominent devotee of Lord Chaitanya, was a Tridandi sannyasi. Furthermore, the seminal acharyas of the 4 recognized Vaishnav Sampradaya, Sri Vishnu Swamini, Sri Nimbarka, Sri Ramanuja, and Sri Madhava, and numerous others in their discipular lines had taken sannyas in Kali Yuga. So, there's precedent. He's giving the precedent here. So, Siddhanta Saraswati accepted and later bestowed sannyas according to the ceremony described in Samskara Dipika. Who wrote Samskara Dipika? Is that Gopal Bhatta? Anybody know? Yes? Gopal Bhatta. So, can you explain what Samskara Dipika is? Is this the... So for the Vaishnava Samskaras, he said that the Samskara Dipika is the book which gives all the procedures for the Samskaras for Vaishnavas. So in there, sannyas is described. In Samskara Dipika, okay, I'll read that again. Saraswati Thakur accepted and later bestowed sannyas according to the ceremony described in the Samskara Dipika for inducting renunciates, which had become identified with a rite known as giving bake to Babaji's. He and his sannyasis dressed in the ankle-length red cloth of the sannyas, similar to that of the Ramakrishna Mission sannyasis whose robes had become familiar and respected in Bengal. Instead of tridandas or uncovered tied sticks like those of the Sri Sampradaya, in other words, just the bare bamboo. Gaudiya sannyasis carry tree dandas wrapped in stripes of red cloth resembling the sannyas rods of the Mayavadis in North India. To the three sticks that represent a dedication of body, mind, and speech and service to the Lord, Srila Saraswati Thakur added another stick to symbolize the jiva. And at the top of the danda placed a small curved stick symbolizing, who knows what that curved stick is for? That's very interesting. So first, Nadeka Dandi, as the Mayavadis, three sticks, body, mind, and soul, and then the four stick, the jiva surrendering body, mind, and soul, and then this piece, representing an axe for cutting non-devotional theories. Gaudiya sannyas differed from that within the established lines of Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva in that it was not awarded solely to men of Brahmana caste. And because horoscopes of prospective candidates were not consulted for ascertaining their fitness for lifelong renunciation. So as far as I understand in Sri Sampradaya, yes. Another long one, and then three long sticks, and then that. One little stick, yeah. He's getting ready. There's a lot of bamboo out here. He wants to make sure to do it right. No, I actually asked Prabhupada if I could take sannyas. He said, first become ideal grihasta, responsible, then you can take sannyas. I was irresponsible. 1972, at the ripe age of 22, I was definitely ready. I was ready for the Mahaprasadam I get in every temple. You get your own room, you get a servant, and if you were a manager, you did not have to manage. You could give that, you could honestly and not irresponsibly give up your management positions because sannyasis didn't manage. So who wouldn't want to take sannyas? Who in their right mind would not want to take sannyas? Traditionally, Bengali Vaishnavas objected that the status of sannyas invites respect and thus transgresses Lord Chaitanya's precept of considering oneself lower than the straw on the street. That sannyas being a role within Varnashram is not meant for followers of Lord Chaitanya, and that the red garb for renunciation is directly against Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita's statement, Rakta Shastra, Yakta Vastra, that you shouldn't wear, it's unbefitting for Vaishnava to wear red cloth. And thus, it is a deviation from the line of the six Goswamis who had worn white, and moreover, is particularly unsuitable for Vaishnavas due to being similar to the apparel of impersonalist sannyasis. So now you can understand what a revolutionary Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was. So first thing, what I think is important to understand, up to that time, renunciation was the renunciation of the Paramhansas, the Babajis, and the Babajis were outside the Varnashram. But the Tri Dandi sannyas is within Varnashram. It's the last ashram of the four ashrams. So we're not supposed to be part of Varna ashram. We're supposed to be transcendental. So the giving sannyas is that now you're going into Varna ashram. Because the only sannyas, the prominent sannyas at that time was the Babajis. And he didn't want to give Babajis because he wanted to show. He said, no, we are not that elevated yet. We still need to practice within Varna ashram. So it explains here why he did that. It's really good. Hold on. Don't leave yet. It's worth staying. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati explained that by embracing sannyas, a devotee undoubtedly maintains a position within Varnashram, which implies that he is still endeavoring for perfection. Because if you take Babaji, then that implies you're perfect. So it's actually a humble position. Prabhupada gave one devotee Babaji because he thought he was going to die. And I was in the temple in which that devotee was living. In fact, I think I lived next to him in that room. And Prabhupada said, just chant 24/7. Sleep as little as possible and don't eat unless people bring you prasadam. So they would bring him his plate. He would open his door. He would eat. He'd put his plate out. We never saw him. That's all. All he was doing was chanting. He couldn't do that. He did it for a few months. But he couldn't. I mean, who could do it? That's the Babaji platform. There's a story. Everyone was complaining about Krishnadas Babaji. He didn't want to go out and preach. He just wanted to chant just all day, take nam. Everyone's complaining about him. So Bhaktisiddhanta said, okay, nobody's going out. We're just going to chant. So he had everyone in the temple just sit down. And after a day or two or three, they were going crazy. And only Krishnadas Babaji could continue to chant. So he, right. Yeah, room and board. Yeah, they put an ad in the paper and said, anyone could come live in the math. All you do is sit down and chant. You know, so like so many people came after 1, 2, 3 days, they couldn't do it. So he's just glorifying him that he's actually, you know, Paramhansa. Yes. So, Tridandi Sannyas implies we're still within Varnashram, we're endeavoring for perfection. Rather than posing as if we've already attained it, for a true Paramhansa is situated in his eternal spiritual identity, far above even the stage of sense control. But one such soul is hardly to be found. The imitative Babaji's knee-length off-white cloth girded at the loins was meant to symbolize the total vairagya and purity of the six Goswamis, yet hardly any could meaningfully embrace that. Indeed, many Babajis shamelessly flouted basic moral principles. Certainly himself, a Paramhansa, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, wanted to establish that the advanced realization of a Paramhansa cannot be attained simply through mimicry, and anyone aspiring for that platform should prudently remain in a humble position as a servant of the Paramahansa. So by giving Tridandi Sannyas, he said, they're above us, we serve them. And then he said, knowing himself unequal to his Paramahansa guru, a Vaishnava accepts sannyas to remain the eternal servant of his guru. Thinking himself unfit to dress as a Paramahansa, a Vaishnava accepts sannyas out of humility, not pride. It also explains that he wanted to establish Daivi Varnashram, and so this was part of it, that giving sannyas within the ashram. And then he said, nowadays many people who do not even perform the devotional service but instead indulge in immorality or are attired in the manner reserved for devotees on the superlative level of spiritual advancement and renunciation. So he's talking about that. There's one other thing I wanted to read. Just one more thing. He gives more reasoning why he did this. Let me read, I think this is the right place. In contrast, the vairagya of Mayavadi sannyasis appeared substantial, for they were exceedingly strict and ascetic. But their rejection of the world was so sweepingly nirvishesh, undiscriminating and unqualified, as to encompass rejection of its essential relationship with Hari. Vairagya is meant to lead to gyan. So his giving sannyas was also... it's explained here. He wanted to establish what real sannyas is. So he had these Mayavadi sannyasis wandering around everywhere. And that was, so he said, this is not real sannyas. He wanted to establish, this is real sannyas, Vaishnava sannyas. What else? You know, so he challenged this idea, you could take sannyas and you'd become God. Here's another thing he did. It shows how controversial he was. It gives us some history. At some point before assuming sannyas, Sri Siddhanta Saraswati had, under the guidance of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, taken the sacred thread in the manner of an upper caste man. In the manner of upper caste men. That in itself was revolutionary, for according to caste norms at the time, Kayastas, he was in a Kayasta family, were disqualified from wearing such sacred threads. Furthermore, only born Brahmins were allowed to enter the sannyas life. Whereupon the Ekadundis relinquished the thread. So they would take sannyas and they'd give up their thread. So he wasn't, according to their norms, qualified to become Brahman, take Upavita, the thread. He took the thread, then he took sannyas and he kept the thread. So everything he was doing was never done before, at least not within that society. That Siddhanta Saraswati, not from a Brahmin family, retained the thread upon renunciation sparked even more surprise and protest from persons ignorant of the differing conceptions of renunciation represented by the Mayavad sannyas. Here's another interesting thing. Now some of you may have heard this. You'll see in Gaudiya Math, they often keep, the sannyasis or renunciates keep a white bead bag. Have you noticed this, any of you? While donning the red cloth, Sri Siddhanta Saraswati kept his bead bag white, considering japa beads representative of the purely transcendental and thus not to be colored with varnashram designations. The japa, Tulsi, is transcendental, so she's not within varnashram, so she can wear white. And sometimes Prabhupada would joke, he said, yeah, grihasthas, you're greater than sannyasis, you're wearing white. So I'll end here if it's late. So are there any questions, comments from any of you? I guess there's not a whole lot of interest in the sannyas ashram here. Yes?
Concerning the point about the begetting children from other men.
The what? Like,
within the purport yesterday, when you quoted that verse from recited by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the five forbidden acts.
Yes.
Yesterday Srila Prabhupada also within the purport stated that in the Vedic times all men could beget wife, can children from all men's wife, something like that. But that could be misconstrued, because really it's your brother, right, one's brother, or a saintly person, the exalted sage, and like in the Pandavas case, the demigods. But it's not like any person could do that. And the brother is to continue the bloodline, the sages, you know, well, he's exalted, and the demigods.
So in Kali Yuga, or Prabhupada's prescription for us is to become saintly, so that we'll have saintly children.
It doesn't mean we can do that.
Yeah, still we can't do it. Yeah. Okay, thank you for clarifying that. Anything else? Yes, Mahamaya?
Someone, I don't even know who, sent me an email with a link to a new video that's narrated by Paul McCartney. So I think, you know, people would probably watch it. It's called Meat is Murder. And it is shocking, it's horrible, but at the same time it could be a tool for preaching. It's showing the inside of slaughterhouses and so many different types of animals. The only thing is it is, I guess, supported by PETA, so he does make a statement that we wouldn't agree with, that milk is not for human consumption. But other than that, it's maybe something that we could send to people who think are right to watch it. It really makes a point. His main point is, if slaughterhouses had glass walls, everyone would be a vegetarian.
Yeah, that's a good point. I always tell people that. And also, I just read recently that 80% of the deforestation going on in the Amazon is for grazing. Cattle will be slaughtered. So if people are interested in environmental improvement, meat eating is the greatest single thing they can do. They said that more pollution is caused by the meat industry than all the total pollution, or equal to the total pollution created by vehicles in the world. And polluting the rivers and the amount of water that's used in raising cattle and slaughterhouses. Yeah. Yes?
And I was thinking, also, there's a positive side, that if people actually got to know cows, they also wouldn't want to be eating them.
Yeah.
Because each one has a personality.
Exactly.
And they are very loving animals and so giving of everything.
I had this idea that we would do a seminar, and before the seminar we would ask everyone what their favorite food is. So for all the non-meat eaters, whatever their favorite food was, we would bring that animal. And then for the first 3 hours of the seminar, we would say, What we're going to do now is you're just going to spend the next 3 hours taking care of this animal, and then come back and let's talk about it.
We had up in North Carolina a vegan who was very strictly vegan, and he started coming to our house because it was the temple at the time. And he wanted to come out when we melt, so he came out. And afterwards he said, okay, when I'm here, I'm not vegan. Because he saw how the cows would be running to, the, you know, they weren't like fighting not to come in to be milked. Or so then he got a whole different attitude towards it.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Hare Krishna. That is a good question. Is it? This book is available on Krishna.com. It is called Animals in Krishna Consciousness, written by Jananda Das. It has many stories, a lot of dog stories about dog devotees. So Adikar is going to speak.
I was going to say,
you'll have to tell him.
Anyway, I saw some letters or writings that Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati wrote about his sannyas disciples. Have you ever seen them?
Yeah.
He was incredibly strict.
This book, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He said, you know, if you dress like a fop, you know, fop was a, like Edwardian kind of person that wants to wear fancy, nice clothing. If you want to dress like that, then you have to go back to wearing a tail, you know, like a, you know, we all grihasas, we have to wear a tail, like the pleats at the back. So I guess that signifies your animal. If you have a tail, you must be an animal. Because he did say the only human form of life is sannyas.
Did he?
Yeah. I've already said that, but he was so strict. He said, if you want to, you know, go to the doctor and stuff, you know, you're not a sannyasi.
You should not have personal cooks. If you have to do any business to take care of yourself, you can't use any of the vehicles in the mosque. You have to walk barefoot.
He's very strict.
But I know when I was in L.A., one devotee, one sannyasi was there, and he said Prabhupada had personally told him that you should be cutting down your eating and sleeping.
Prabhupada told who?
To Sudama when he was a sannyasi.
Oh, I see.
And when I was in Los Angeles in 1972, so that... Mm. But as you say, what Bhakti Siddhanta said was extreme. And he said, you should be the servant of everyone in the mosque. You should not allow anybody to serve you. Because there's also this idea of, okay, now you're in an exalted position, so people will honor you and serve you and offer you
opulence. But he was the acharya. So in another part of that book, he was saying how opulence is meant for preaching, and that, you know, having opulence is impressive for non-devotees. But then, you know, on the other hand, he's a little bit difficult to understand. But I guess he was the acharya. So his position was different. He'd already proved his renunciation by living in the hut for 10 years and like that.
It seems that from what he's saying to his sannyasis is that we can have all this opulence, you just have to be extremely renounced yourself. I mean, very, very strict.
Hare Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.